Welcome, welcome to Reza After Dark. We still need to find a jingle. We haven't yet. Because it needs to be sexy but also funny, right? Because there ain't no sexy without funny. Maybe you know this song, Marvin Gaye, Sexual Healing. It's a pretty good song. A very old song, too. It is from 1982. I wasn't even born then. Crazy. Still a good tune. It's Tuesday night, 14th of May. You're in for some hot shit. I'm going to read out of the book King Stories. And how I've done this the last times is I just read, because I'm two-thirds through. And I have so many other books I'm reading at home, so I felt like, might as well read that on air. Two birds, one stone. And today's story is a bit longer, so we might have to split it up in two sessions. Because I still need a break in between, play some hot music. So we shall see what happens. I thought I have some guests in tonight, but next week. I'm going to a workshop this weekend in Auckland. Horny stories, how to write horny stories, basically. Or sexy stories. I feel like I need to get back into writing. And next Tuesday, Katie Lowe's from the show Highs and Lows will be with me, and she's going to interview me about all the things I learned. And then we're probably going to write some sexy stories together. Who knows? So that's what's up the next 60-ish minutes. And the story today is called The Lost Performance of the High Priestess of the Temple of Horror by Carmen Maria Machado. I'm excited. Hope you are too. And I'm gonna let you guys enjoy the song and come back in a minute. If you need sexual healing, you're at the right address for tonight here on Raglan Community Radio 98.1. And how Katie said it so nice last weekend when I told her about my new show, Reza After Dark, on Tuesday night, 8:30 till 9:30. She's like, I love this town. Because only here things like that are possible, where we just sit down on the radio and read kinky shit. So here we go, people of the night. King Stories, and we're reading the story. I'm reading the story, The Lost Performance of the High Priestess of the Temple of Horror, it's a mouthful, by Carmen Maria Machado. I would never forget the night I saw Maxa decompose before me. I was a young woman, barely budded, but I'd been able to make my way to Le Theatre du Grand Genou by telling my mother I needed to go to church. My mother was a devout woman, a seamstress, and when I walked out the door, she kissed me and said she was pleased I was seeking God's wisdom. When she pulled away, I saw there was a black spot of blood where she'd brushed a pricked finger against the sleeve of my coat. The entire way to the theater, a crow had fluttered around me. It flew from rooftop to rooftop, occasionally dropping down the cobblestone to fix me in its gaze before ascending again. Its eye looked like an onyx, and an oily prism blazed over its black feathers. My mother, had she seen it, would have told me the devil was leading me. But she was not there, and she did not see that. The bird could just as easily been following me as if I were the devil. I kept walking, and it kept leading or following until I turned a corner and it ascended to a rooftop and disappeared. The theater was built at the end of a narrow alley, limned with white sand-colored buildings, pocked with shuttered windows and wrought iron terraces. For a brief moment, the chatter of pedestrians fell away, and the Grand Guignol glowed in the dusk. The cobblestones beneath my feet were the same I'd been walking on, but suddenly their unevenness made me aware of every rotation of my hip, every inversion of my foot. I felt like the theater took two steps away from me for every step I took toward it, stretching the space before me to an ever-doubling length. The crow dove at me from a rooftop, shrieking like a djinn. I ran toward the threshold. The light pouring from the open door throbbed like a bruised thumb. I had not precisely told my mother a lie. The theater had once been a church, though that night the room was hot with spectators instead of congregants, and just as cramped and feverish. The stage was claustrophobic, like a too-hot whisper from an intoxicated stranger. The cherubs that lined the ceiling had a demonic air, an askew quality, and seemed glazed in our collective oils. The smell of bodies was heightened, women's menstruation and the swampy folds of men. Ooh, swampy folds of men! Now that is a line, you guys. We all breathed in sync and through our mouths. I sat toward the front of the room, pressed between a man who kept glancing at me in confusion and desire, and a couple who gripped each other's bodies like they were about to be borne away by a flood. When Mexa came onto the stage, it was as if a window had been opened to allow a breeze, and a gale had entered instead. I felt the room bend around her. She was not beautiful in a traditional sense, but her dark eyes beheld all of us as if we were slightly familiar to her. Her mouth was painted the red of clotted blood. The play concerned a wife who hatched a scheme to murder her husband so that she might live with her lover. Mexa played the strutting spouse with such assurance, I forgot I sat shoulder to shoulder with my fellow Parisians. Instead, I felt as if I were the play's maid who appeared at the edge of the stage from time to time so that she might overhear the strategic dialogue staged to divert suspicion. The plan was so nefarious, so meticulously plotted, I was certain I could reproduce it if I cared to. She turned to the audience from time to time, addressing us with scorn, sounding a little disappointed in our prudishness, our lack of imagination. We did not care. We arced toward her voice like petals to the sun. In the final act, the wife lured her husband to her bedroom, where a large traveling trunk rested open on a tarpaulin. This was the plan, to murder him and pack him into the trunk, which she would take with her on a long journey. But before she was able to execute her plan, her husband seized the pistol and shot her dead. Her wrapped her in her own tarpaulin and placed her onto her own trunk. It was heaved high in the air by an attendant and placed at the edge of the stage. The fiend murmured to himself, "She thought of everything," and then cackled as he walked off stage. Then a tremendous bang, as the front of the trunk fell open to reveal her body, twisted in a grotesque knot. The audience let out a collective breath. A woman wept silently in the row before me, and her companion turned to console her. I waited for the curtain to close on her death, but as I watched, her body began to teem with a living curtain of maggots. Someone screamed. It was me. It was me. As her flesh blackened and greened and sank in around her bones like fallen cake. I felt like a girl child trapped in a nightmare. Some tiny corner of me knew that the effect was done with something real, lights or clay, but could not convince any other part of me that this was anything but the end. When the performance was over, I sat there picking at my skirt as the audience stood and shrieked and murmured confidences and eventually departed. I did not wish to return home just yet when the nightmare of the performance lingered so close in my mind, and I felt warm and drowsy. No one came to move me, and I fell asleep there in my seat. A slam, wrathed and whispering, woke me. The theater was dark as a tomb, a sight from a candle burning in my periphery. I reached for my throat as though I expected it to be wet or gone or bitten, but only felt my own rapid pulse. I turned toward the whispering and saw one of the confessional booths had been closed, and from within there was a gasping sound, like a woman being strangled. I stood and walked to the screen, pressed my face close. Inside, the dark-haired woman was bent over, a man rutting behind her. Her face turned to the side, and she saw me. But instead of screaming, she pressed a white finger to the pillow of her mouth. I turned and fled. When I returned that night, my mother asked me what the sermon had been about. I went to her and admired her embroidery. "The sinful flesh and the living word," I said. She kissed me on the cheek. Her finger was still bleeding. When my mother died of her wasting illness a few months later, I left her home. Thrown out by the landlord who'd asked for my body in lieu of rent, and found myself in front of the Grand Guignol once more. I had some money on my person, enough for a few nights at an inn, a few hot meals, but still I turned some over for a ticket when I saw Maxa on the poster from the street. When I entered the theater, I saw once again the fleur-de-lis wallpaper surrounding me like so many seats, like I was at the center of a large and pungent fruit, something unfathomably exotic. That night, Maxa gouged out her right eye with a knitting needle. I don't remember why. Besides, all explanations and plot contrivances were weak beneath the weight of the violence. She dipped her head forward and her hand twitched with new weight. I thought it would be white and smooth as an egg, but when she pulled her hand away, it looked like a stillborn chick, a round mass of wet and grizzle. I realized after she let it fall to the stage that I'd been holding my breath, and the influx of air was sweet as summer rainfall. At the end of the performance, I lingered near the stage, which was covered in gore. A young woman came out with a bucket and began to slop brown water along the wood. She looked up and saw me, but said nothing. Feeling bold, I hitched my skirts and climbed up, stepping over a menacing streak of red. I could feel her eyes on me as I walked past her. Backstage, Maxa was sitting on her chair, looking ravished. Her curls were already half undone, as if she'd been out on the water. A book was open in the dip of her skirt, and she was glancing at it with her good eye as she unpinned her hair. "Sabine!" she shouted. In front of her loomed a mirror the color of rust. In its reflection, I looked wide-eyed, feral, faint as a spirit. "Sabine, do you..." she said, and then flicked her gaze toward me. "May I help you?" Behind me, I heard footsteps, and the young woman, Sabine, appeared. She stepped around me and got very close to Max's face. Her fingernails scraped along Max's temple, like a cat begging to be fed. And as the black peeled away, Max's eyelid emerged beneath it. "I'm looking for work, for room and board," I said. "Running away to the Grand Guignol?" she said, her lips twitching slightly upward. "This is not a place for children to escape to. Won't your mother be looking for you?" The effect seized the hairs on her brow, and she hissed a little. Sabine rolled her eyes, kept picking. "I'm not a child," I said, "and my mother's dead." She blinked her eyes hard, the one that had been encased in blood, blinking a little more slowly than the other. Then she turned toward me, her whole body leaning from its chair as if she were drunk. Did she recognize me from that night many months ago? It was unclear. Her eyes were bright, as if with fever. I felt that if all the lights went out, they would glitter like will-o'-wisps and lead me into the darkness. "Very well, Bess," she said. "My name is not Bess," I said. It's now." She hiked up her dress and pulled a flask from her garter. Something, disappointment maybe, flicked through the muscles of Sabine's face, but then it went flat, cold. "Don't you have to ask Camille before? I'll deal with him," said Maxa. She lit a cigarette, stood. If anyone's looking for me, I'll be in the alley. She tipped her head back and sucked at the flask as if it were a teat, and then stood and drifted into the shadows. Sabine handed me the mop. Even when the Grand Guignol was empty, it was never empty. Fat mice waddled casually along the baseboards, searching for what had rolled out of view. We chased bats out of the theater daily, an explosion of fur and leather. Crows, maybe even my crow, were taken to sauntering and casually searching for food or baubles left behind by terrified audience members. Camille did not seem to understand why Maxa had hired me, though how could he, as I hardly understood it myself. But since I slept in her dressing room in the theater and Maxa fed me, he did not object. His round glasses did not stay on his nose very well. I offered to bend the wire, but he pushed them up nervously and turned away. Max's vanity was cluttered with what she needed and more. Bulbed bottles of scent with sleek lines, a small scissors, mascaras and powders the color of chalk, lipstick and a metal tracer, coal for her eyes, a hot curler, rouge, a fat brush tipped in pink dust, pencils, old scripts, a pair of bone-colored dice. It seemed like a place where spells were cast, that by scooping up a resident mouse and opening its throat into her wine glass, she might be able to curse whomever she pleased. But there was no need for animal blood. Powdered carmine, which Sabine told me, was created by boiling insects. Arrived in small sacks, and I spent my waking hours mixing and reheating the concoction like a vampirus. At night before sleep, I stared at the ceiling and thought about my mother, the gap of her, the tenacity of her voice. Every so often someone would come by to the theater's doors, rattling them with a drunken ferocity, and then their footsteps would recede. I understood better than most. I was outside those doors once, but I never would be again. I could have been out on the streets, hungry and terrified. Here, the questions that seemed to follow me my entire life did not seem relevant. I was invisible in a way that soothed me. My identity, my inclinations, my desires, it was all open for discussion. Before my mother's death, when I performed the duty of pious daughter with rigor, there was a neighbor woman who often watched me from her window. My mother seemed to think of her as a useful eye, keeping watch on our door when she went to the market. But the woman never seemed to be watching with anything besides curiosity and disgust. Once when I played jacks on the stoop, she came out and stood at the bottom of the steps with a basket slung on her hip. "Where's your father, child?" she'd ask. "He is no longer here," I said, for that was what my mother had said when dead could not reach her lips. She snorted as though she'd suspected as much. "And who does your mother think she's fooling?" I caught my ball and looked up at her face, heart with suspicion and even anger. I didn't know how to answer. "We all know who she laid with," she said. "Look at you." Then she shook her head and walked down the street. A week into my tenure, I woke to find Maxa sprawled over her vanity, moaning into her arms. I stood, alarmed, and when she did not respond, I rushed out to the theater where Sabine was scraping candle wax off the floor. "Maxa is ill," I gasped, bent over from my pulsing heart. Sabine stood with no tension, slowly whipping the blade on her skirt as she followed me backstage. She knelt down and looked at Maxa, who had fallen asleep. "Wine or opium, Maxa?" she said loudly. Maxa moaned a little. "Both?" Sabine said. Maxa slid from the dressing table and crawled into my cot. She was asleep before she finished her ascent, and her body went soft bend over the wooden frame. "Come," Sabine said. "If this is the new arrangement, you should know what needs to be done." We stepped into the sunshine and took off down the road. Sabine withdrew a novel from her basket and read as we walked. I could not see the cover, but when I tried to read the words, she twitched and turned the book so I could not see. We didn't speak until we arrived at the pharmacist's, and Sabine located a blue bottle on the shelf. She shook it a little and held it up to the light. "What is it?" I asked. "Recette secrète," she said. "What?" "Just some nonsense, but Maxa gets what she desires." She closed the bottle in her fist. Her expression was flat and cross. "Maxa watches you," she said. "She watches you like a cat watches a bird." "Jealously?" she snorted. "Hungrily." Back at the theater, Sabine lifted Max's feet up on the cot and then dragged her torso upright against the wall. She slapped her lightly on the cheek, and Maxa moaned piteously. Sabine handed me the bottle. I poured out the liquid with a trembling hand and laid the spoon against Maxa's tongue. She bit the metal and swallowed listlessly. Her eyes fluttered open, and I felt like I was at the edge of the mouth of a cave, with every intention of jumping in. Well, this is taking a while to get sexy, but hold on tight. I mean, if this is not your jam, you can also listen to the show from last week, where I was on air with Jonathan, and we were talking about what we find sexy in other people and what we find sexy about each other and stuff like that. So maybe that's more your jam. Then, by all means, check out reglandradio.com and go into the archives. This is one of my favorite songs, Sananda Matreya, Sign Your Name. Pretty sexy song. Reza After Dark, you guys.
To
Maitreya. Sign Your Name from 1987. I was one. I remember that song as a kid. And I remember the music video too, which was a very sexy music video with him, who's a gorgeous looking guy, was back then, and a woman that he slowly caresses. And it's very, very sensual, which is what we were talking about last week with Yona, what we find sensual or sexy. And I think the word vulnerability was thrown around quite a lot. And he asked me today, oh, you should talk about, what did he say? I'm just trying to find it. Pussy eating. Yeah. And I was like, oh, do you want me to tell everybody how good you are at that? And he's like, yeah, desert boy can do it right. And I'm like, oh gosh. But maybe he needs to talk about that next time he's on my show. Anyways, you're listening to Reza After Dark. Yes, this is Raglan Community Radio 98.1. And it's a bit of a different show. I just started reading Kink Stories, and we're not even halfway through with this story, The Lost Performance of the High Priestess of the Temple of Horror. So it's a pretty big build-up, but hey, bear with me. So we shall continue. After I'd helped Maxa prepare for the night's performance, I was allowed to sit in the audience, though not to occupy a paying chair. I thought I would become tired or bored of the same rotating seats of plays every night, but I could not stop watching Maxa. She exhibited control over every twitch. She never laughed when she might have laughed, never put a crack in the tension. Every night, Maxa screamed on stage. Her scream was a magnificent thing, a resonating animal that climbed out of her throat and gambolled around the room. Gambolled? Gambolled around the room. No idea what that word means. Some nights, if the room was particularly hot, I swore I could see the ribbons of her voice emanating from her. She screamed as she was raped and strangled, disemboweled, stabbed. She screamed as she was consumed by wildcats, shot in the gut, shot in the head, here accompanied by an uncanny whistling sound as if the scream were coming through the newly created orifice. Great word, orifice? Orifice. Me learning words. She screamed as she was beaten, lit on fire. Audience members would stagger into the street to vomit, and at the end of the night, the cobblestone street was studded with glistening puddles. Not much sex going on just yet, guys. We shall see, we shall see. There were always a few doctors in the audience sitting at the end of their rows. They were necessary, as fainting of audience members was also a regular occurrence. Mostly men, which caused a great deal of snickering and speculation among us. The prevailing theory for this fact was that women were always afraid and covering their eyes, and men watched what they could not, and then found themselves unable to bear it. But Maxa knew the truth and told me the reason for the fainting. Most men, she said, would only see bodily fluids when they caught their ejaculate in their hands or if their life ended at the wrong end of a brawl. But for women, gore was a unit of measurement. Monthly cycles, the egg white slip of arousal, the blood of virginity stolen through force of hand or the force of law, childbirth, fists splitting the skin of the skull, the leak of milk, tears. I once saw a woman in the street who had been knocked about by a lover or perhaps a customer. Her eye socket looked crushed. The new shape of her head made my stomach curdle. She was weeping, but the salt tears were pink. She wiped them from her filthy face and looked at them on her hand, the color of a rare diamond. "Even my tears bleed," she said, and staggered down the street. Men occupy terra firma because they are like stones. Women seep because they occupy the filmy gauze between the world of the living and the dead, Maxa said. She was always saying stuff like that, but after watching her perform every night, I began to believe it. Weeks and months, Maxa died again and again. One of them in the early spring, death by slicing with a trick razor, was among the most dramatic I'd ever seen. I had watched the rehearsals but could not wait to see the final effect. Lewis's forehead gleamed with sweat beneath the stage lights. He was more scared than Maxa, I realized. But then again, that was easy. Maxa wasn't afraid at all. From behind the curtain, I glanced out into the audience. When I squinted, I could see that their collective foreheads were hazy with filth. When the curtains kissed, I glanced out again and realized that all of their foreheads were crossed with soot. Soot? It was Mercredi de Grande. Mercredi de Cendre? Some French, you guys. I watched Louise lash thin lines across Max's breasts, blood seeping down her white slip. She shrieked in pain, her eyes glittering with pleasure. Then he drove the razor into her side. A stream of blood left her as though she'd punctured a wine cask. The dagger's blade, I knew, sank easily into its handle, and the blood I had mixed and warmed myself, but the effect was alarming nonetheless. When the play ended, the audience went to their feet and would not stop clapping until Camille told them to leave. Backstage, Sabine staggered beneath the weight of her water bucket. She came up behind Maxa. The thin metal handle drew a white strip across her red hand. "I want Bess to wash me," Maxa said. Sabine flinched and then dropped the bucket to the floor. Water sloshed on the wood and drew up what was dried there. I barely heard her receding footsteps. Maxa slumped into her chair. In her hand, she held her removed eye. I knelt before her and took it, a piece of chicken fat bound in twine and dipped in the carmine and glycerin, because the butcher had no beef eyes for us today, and set it wetly upon the vanity. I knew that the dark dip in her face was merely paint, but still, when I approached it with a damp rag, I felt something sour swell up inside me. Maxa lifted her legs and balanced the balls of her feet on another chair. The fake blood had left dark lines down her body. I rubbed the cleft behind her knee, not wanting to pull on the hair. She watched me, her lips pursed a little as if she wanted to moan, but needed to stop herself. My wreck felt like a living thing, a snake warmed by sunlight. "My uncle was a garlic farmer," Maxa said, closing her eyes. "Hardneck garlic. Have you had it?" "No," I said, wringing out the rag in a bucket. "It's wild and peppery, the best you can have. My parents sent me there one summer when they worried the city was too wild for me. I would sit in the field and listen to the garlic grow. It sounded like a chorus of insects. I could hear a crackling like onion skin. The air was green and sharp. They had such soft voices." Though outside the audience was talking, laughing, their voices were muted, as though the room was a womb. "My uncle would harvest them and dry them braided together and hanging in bundles from the ceiling. The roots were like little hairs, and the bulbs were purple as a man's egg." She laughed a little. "My uncle would scold me, but sometimes I'd pull a clove and eat it raw. It tasted like..." Her mouth parted in memory, and in her mouth her tongue glistened like an oyster. "It tasted like a spell. When I got back, my father said I looked changed, and I think I was. I think the garlic tipped something in me, kindling for a fire, a long time coming." "Where is your father?" I asked. Maxa opened her eyes, and her leg twitched beyond my grasp. She ran her hand along her thigh and stared at the pinkish water on her fingertips. "Where is your father?" she replied. I did not know what to say. She leaned down and took my chin in her hand. "What was he?" "Maghrebin." "Maghrebin? Your skin is gold in this light." I flinched. "I don't know," I said. Maxa looked at my face like she wanted to bite it. Instead, she stood and examined herself. She seemed pleased. She walked behind me and gripped my shoulders in her powerful hands, and I felt blood rushing into the muscles that had been like stone. She worked her way around my flesh as if it were a spirit board, and her fingers were on the planchette, torturing answers and poems out of my pain. I writhed and twitched beneath her. "Thank you," I whispered, but she was already turning away. Max's flat was a few streets over from the Grand Guignol, on the hill, in a rickety tenement at the top of a narrowed staircase. She did not answer the door when I knocked, but the knob turned with no resistance. Somehow, I had imagined a room bathed in light, a kind of temple, but it was closer to a courtesan's boudoir. At one corner of the room was a beautiful divan, with plush gold and red brocade and single sensuous loop of an armrest. The walls were hung with posters from the Grand Guignol, a daguerreau type of woman I did not recognize. The shelf was piled with books, a tiny brass pot, a horsehair brush, an articulated mouse skeleton in a bell jar. Her bed was covered in a fur blanket on which was draped a massive wolfhound. The dog glanced at me and growled a little, the muscles tensing and releasing in liquid bursts beneath her hide, but Maxa made a barely audible shh, and she felt silent, her gaze fixed on Maxa's form. "This is Athena," she said, gesturing to the creature. "Hello, my little Bess," she said. "I'm glad you're here. I need to eat and bathe." When she let her robe drop on the floor, I finally saw the body that I'd only caught glimpses of. Her thighs were round, and the hair between her legs a rusty brown, through which the slit of her sex was visible. Her stomach had a low pooch, like she was early with child, and her breasts were small as apples, thin white scars clustered near the clefts of her. I drew a bath for her, and after she lowered her body into the water, I cut her meat pie into chunks and blew on them until they were cold. She wanted no metal, so I fed her by hand. Her mouth was warm and tight. She was careful not to bite, but used the edges of her teeth to pull the meat from my fingers. She let me sleep at her feet, near Athena, curled there. I felt the jabs of her feet as she got comfortable, sought pockets of warmth. In my dreams, she walked down the streets of Paris on a winter night, and I followed behind. Green waxy scapes pushed from between the fine hairs of her mink coat, and when the wind blew, they rustled, and with a creak, reached further out. Her body blotted out the moon. She was an ambulatory garden, a beacon in a dead season, life where life should not grow. Oh, that's very poetic, you guys. I'm just wondering, are they finally going to do it? Because that's obviously what's going to happen, I think. You're listening to Reza After Dark. I'm reading King Stories. We got another 20-ish minutes, so I'm not sure if we're going to make it. But then you have to tune in next week for the ending, right? I'm going to listen to, how fitting, a French artist, MC Zola with Caroline. It's the live version. It's one of the most beautiful songs and very much reminds me of my first love when I was a teenager. And yeah, that's from 1998. It's about right. Enjoy.
Comme des enfants, je t'aime un peu beaucoup, à la folie passionnément, mais à la suite d'une douloureuse déception sentimentale. D'humeur chaleureuse, je devenais brutal. La haine d'un être n'est pas dans nos prérogatives. Tchernobyl, Tchernodébile, jalousie radioactive. Caroline était une amie, une superbe fille. Je repense à elle, à nous, à nos cornets vanille, à sa boulimie de fraises, de framboises, de myrtilles, à ses délires futiles, à son style pacotille. Je suis las de trêve qui pique ton cœur. Las de trêve qui pique ton cœur. Las de trêve qui pique ton cœur. Caroline. Je cherche votre bonheur. Je suis l'homme qui tombe à pic pour prendre ton cœur. Il faut se tenir à carreau. Carreau, ce message vient du cœur. Une pyramide de baisers, une tempête d'amitié, une vague de caresses, un cyclone de douceur, un océan de pensées. Caroline, je t'ai offert un building de tendresse. J'ai une peur bleue, je suis poursuivi par l'armée rouge. Pour toi j'ai pris des billets verts, il a fallu que je bouge. Pyromane de ton cœur, canadaire de tes frayeurs. Je t'ai offert une symphonie de couleurs. Elle est partie, mazo, avec un vieux macho qu'elle avait rencontré dans une station de métro. Quand je les vois main dans la main, vivement le même égo. Je sens un pincement dans son cœur, mais elle n'ose dire un mot. C'est que je suis las de trêve qui pique ton cœur. Las de trêve qui pique ton cœur. Las de trêve qui pique ton cœur, Caroline. Claude, merci pour le microphone, Jean-Luc de Riragamuffin. Pour te parler d'une amie qu'on appelle Caroline. Elle était ma dame, elle était ma cam, elle était ma vitamine. Elle était ma drogue, ma dope, ma coke, mon crack, mon amphétamine. Caroline.
à elle, femme actuelle, 20 ans, jeune et jolie. Remets donc le film à l'envers, magnéto de la vie pour elle. Faut-il l'admettre, des larmes coulées, hémorragie oculaire. Vive notre amitié du passé, du présent, je l'espère, du futur. Je suis passé pour être présent. Dans ton futur, la vie est un jeu de cartes. Paris, un casino, je joue les roues, cœur, carreau.
A song, MC Zola with Caroline. And I think you don't need to be able to understand French to know what he's singing about, right? He's just praising how beautiful she is and all the things about Caroline. Reza After Dark, Tuesday night, 8:30 till 9:30. And we started reading the King's Story, The Lost Performance of the High Priestess of the Temple of Horror. And we're not quite where I thought we would be by now, but hey, just bear with me. All right, let's continue. Spring came. One morning, Maxa woke me from my cot by yanking my hair. "I need you," she said. "There's a car outside." As I stood, she undressed me, removing my nightgown and digging around in my trunk for a day dress. I stood shivering, my arms crossed over my breasts. When she'd finished, she unknotted my braid and gathered my hair into a soft chignon at the base of my neck. In the car, our knees came together, bone knocking against bone. "Have you ever had your fortune told, Bess?" Maxa asked me. I shook my head. I hadn't, either, until I came to Paris. As a girl, I had a doll who meant to tell little girls' fortunes. She had a skirt made of slips of paper, and you would ask a question and open her skirts, and there would be answers waiting for you. Aren't there always answers waiting for you when you open up a girl's skirt? Ah! Just saying. I consulted her daily. Once, I asked her if I was meant to be upon the stage, and when I unfolded the slip, it said that I should give up, as evidenced by my doubt. So I shredded her little skirt until there was nothing left. I felt a terrible itch at my neck and reached behind to scratch it. My nails dug into the soft give of my skin and I drew blood. Maxa leaned in and examined my fingers, dipping her own into the gore and examining what she found there. Many years ago, I visited a woman who told me many things that would eventually come to pass. But what happened past those events, she said, was shrouded in mist and I needed to return to her once I met a mulatresse. Oh, that's what she is. Okay. Now I understand the weird neighbor's comment. So mulatresse is the word for mulat. Yeah, we don't say that word, actually. The car stopped at Rue Ville du Temple and Maxa paid and stepped out to the street. I followed her down the road where carts stood pitched against buildings and people of all types stood at low tables covered in fabric. Maxa did not slow down at their tables. Instead, she went to a particular door and knocked. A young girl answered. She tilted her head suspiciously up at Maxa, but Maxa handed her a small green stone, which she examined briefly. She shouted something in a language I did not understand into the house, and from its depths a voice answered back. Maxa pushed past the girl, who pocketed the stone and smiled at me as if we shared a secret. The room the girl led us to was dark and narrow, cluttered with bric-a-brac and narrow table. The woman who sat at the table was young, perhaps the girl's mother, and she sat in front of a brass bowl and a glass pitcher filled with water. "You've come back," she said. Maxa gestured toward me. "I want the mist cleared," she said. I sat in a chair in the corner of the room. A thin white cat leaped easily into my lap, despite her ancient gait, and rolled her skull against my breastbone. The woman looked at me, her expression unreadable. Then she tilted her pitcher toward us and filled the bowl with water. She waited for it to settle, and then withdrew a vial from her sleeve. A single drop of oil struck the surface, and after a moment it spread outward. She cupped her hands around the bowl's edge and gazed deeply into it. I looked over at Maxa. Her face had lost its lazy, indolent softness. She was alert, tense, her lower lip pinched beneath her tooth. The woman looked up at me again and then returned her gaze to the water. "You are a conduit for violence, but not a host. It passes through you," she said. "Is that all? You will die a violent death." I saw Maxa gather the red tablecloth in her hands and feared she would yank the bowl and table over. "Maxa," I said, "she's just a foolish woman." The woman's eyes snapped at me and then drifted back down to her bowl. "What do you see in there about my friend?" Maxa asked. The woman shook her head. Maxa dug into her glove and removed another franc. The woman slipped it into her purse and gazed back down. "On a distant shore, your lover will find you," she said. She looked back at me. "What are you?" she asked me, and I had no answer. Back in her flat, Maxa seemed agitated. She spun around, pinching the air as though reaching for something, and then finally alighted upon a black box on her vanity. When she opened it up, I saw soft spheres resting in between crumpled cloth. She removed one and held it up. "A fig," she said, "all the way from Spain." She handed it to me. It was warm and dense and heavy, and a milky drop of nectar clung to the fruit's opening. "Where did you get these?" I asked. "Oh, an admirer left them for me after a show," she said. "Eat." I did not know whether to bite or split, but Maxa bit into hers, and I did as well. In the bite, I could see hundreds of tiny seeds, shadowed and clustered like orphans, at an open door. I pushed into the opening with my finger, and the fruit clung to me like rugged, drawing me in. "It's the flower," she said. "It's grown inward, see? It is less beautiful but much sweeter for the effort. I'm told wasps crawl into its depths and die." The fruit slid down my throat, but I could not bring myself to take another bite. I do not know when I first understood that Marcel was Max's lover. She never talked about him. Marcel was a queer figure, always fluttering and talking, the opposite of Max's languid substance. He was mealy and pale and perpetually damp. Something one might uncover by inverting a stone in a garden. His hair was his only redeeming feature, long and soft. But I noticed that Maxa's chin twitched downward in his presence, and his never did. I did not like how he touched her, as if he owned her from her skin inward, the way he tangled his fingers in her hair and pulled as if drawing on a leash and pinched her breasts and thighs as though testing her tenderness. He did not like me either. He called me Max's little Arab, her whore, her vase de nuit. One evening, after the two of them had polished off a bottle of Arouya Noir, he put a cigarette out on my skirts. I yelped and leaped up from the divan, shaking the material so it did not catch on fire. From beneath heavy lids, Maxa watched his performance without comment, even when I looked at her for guidance. Then she yawned, her tongue black with wine. Only the next day did she take me out to buy me a new skirt and laughed as if we were dearest and oldest friends catching up after an absence. It was Marcel's idea to take us both to see La Revue Négrée at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. It was brand new and nearly impossible to attend, but Marcel knew a man who knew a stagehand. Maxa brought me to her apartment for preparation. The dress she found was short, heavy with silver beads, beautiful, despite being shapeless. When I reached out to run my fingers through the fringe, Maxa slipped my hand away. "Hair first," she said, pushing me down in the chair. Maxa let my hair down and tried to take a brush to it. The brush caught resisted. There is a comma. She instead ran her fingers through from root to tip, lightly tugging at the snarls and knots. "There's no reason to let it be like this," she told me. In the mirror, my hair made me look indescribably young. I looked away. "It's always been this way," I said. "We should change that, Bess." "Why do you call me Bess?" I said. She lifted my hair up like a curtain and let it drop over my shoulders. I thought she would refuse to answer, but she spoke, her voice curved with a smile. "Have you read The Highwayman?" she asked. I shook my head. "A lover read it to me," she said. "He brought it from Scotland." She fondled the curls that gathered around my ears. "A landlord's daughter falls in love with a brigand, and he is betrayed to soldiers." She tucked again, and I yelped at the pain. She rubbed my scalp soothingly and then opened a drawer behind her. With a whisper, she looped a scarf over my wrist, binding it to the arm of the chair. "Maxa!" "The soldiers come," she bound the other arm. "And tie Bess, that's her name, Bess, to her bedpost and place a musket between her breasts. When she lifts the scissors into the air, I struggle against the bonds, but it feels perfunctory. I know what is going to happen. She knows that they're plotting to kill her lover as soon as he returns, so she finds the trigger of the gun," Maxa said. Then her finger moved in the moonlight. The first cut was crisp and terrible. Her musket shattered the moonlight. Another. Shattered her breast in the moonlight. Again. And warned him with her death. I hadn't realized how much my scalp had been aching until so much of me was gone. My hair ended in a jagged horizon at my chin. "I look like an urchin," I said. "I should leave you like this," she said to my reflection. I believed that she would, but then she laughed. "I'm not finished." She pulled the chair sideways and sat directly across from me, bringing the blade close to my face. Every dry snip sounded like a mouse setting off a trap. Dozens of snips, dozens of mice struggling to their doom. "So she died for her lover," I said. "He dies for her too," she said. At the end, he's shot down on the road." With the weight lifted, my hair gathered up into the curl I hadn't seen since I was a girl. She oiled it a little, then brought a hot iron to the ends, curling them under. After, she pasted curls to my forehead with petroleum jelly. "Spit curls," she said. "One for every man you've kissed." "I haven't..." "Shh." "Maxa," I said, "you're still upset about the fortune teller?" She shook her head as she dragged her finger down her tongue, sharpening the curl by my ear to a point. "No," she said, "you're not a mulatresse." That was my mistake. The reading was similarly an error. I stared at the tapestry behind her head, some Eastern cloth tacked into the wall, a tableau of tigers and elephants. "What are you?" she said. "Tell me." "I don't know." "What sort of an answer is that? You must know." "My mother was a teacher," I said. "My father died when I was young." A bobby pin scraped my skull and I flinched. Maxa looked slightly deflated, but then she bruised herself at her vanity. She lifted up one of her bottles and poured out a spoonful. I opened my mouth obediently like a child, and the liquid was bitter. I asked her what it was, and she did not reply. The powder puff huffed over my face and I coughed. I felt a warmth gathering in my belly. The air softened. Maxa had been chewing on fennel seed. Her breath was sweet. "What country did your mother travel to teach the heathens?" I closed my eyes as if trying to remember, even though I knew I did not. "A warm place," I said. "She was sent back after the war." "What do you remember of the warm place?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Trees."
"Don't be stupid, Bess. What kind of trees?" I tried to imagine them, but as soon as one appeared in my mind's eye, I saw my mother, laughing, bending down for me, and I felt my mouth tremble.
Oh, now," she said.
"Never mind. Now is not the time. You have to be still." I clenched my anus and felt my organs settle in me. She drew on my face, and it felt like she was drawing forever, like she was tracing my whole self,
because I'd faded into myself. Like I'd become a smooth dome of skin and she needed to put back what had vanished. She lifted her gilded hand mirror and inverted it before me. I did not recognize myself. My skin was pale as death, paler even, and the cupid's bow of my lips powdered unnaturally. My eyes were smudged dark as if I'd been struck twice. I felt old. Not old as Maxa, nor old as my mother before the illness took her, but old enough to have seen all of time in its infinite cycles, looping over and over again. She unbound my arms and tossed the scarves back into a drawer. I lifted them and rubbed at the marks. The dress Maxa had bought for me was oddly square. The style, yes, but beneath it my body's elements were subsumed. My new face now sat atop a neutered body, a body as soft and sexless as an infant's. I shivered. Maxa produced a mink coat and put it on me. The hairs graced my skin, and I had the uncanny sensation that a living thing was slung over my shoulders, breathing intimately against me. Marcel came in without knocking, and he bent to the floor to gather the leavings from the haircut. He rasped between his fingers with an expression of disgust before dropping it to the floor. Then we were down in the street, and Marcel was opening a door, and a cab whisked us down the street. The car bobbed and weaved and jolted over the cobblestones like we were small, and we were running, and I could not tell if we were the escaping prey or the fox pursuing it. Oh my, you guys, it's almost 9:30. I guess this is it. We are halfway through the story, not even. Got a few more pages, so that's going to be next week here on Resa After Dark on 98.1 Raglan Community Radio. I read to you the story, The Lost Performance of the High Priestess of the Temple of Horror. If you can't wait how it finishes, look on my Instagram, Reza Mutanu. King Stories, edited by R.O. Kwon and Gareth Greenwell. So you can also just purchase it. I'm sure the Raglan Library doesn't have it, but I'm sure you can find it somewhere else. And we're going to finish tonight with one of my new favorite songs, Hareini from Ravid Plotnik, an Israeli artist. I'm trying really hard to learn the words. And maybe one day, you guys. That was Reza After Dark. Tune in next Monday for Rendezvous with Reza if you want, 7 to 8:30. Or Tuesday to finish the story. Take care. Good night.
אני מקבל על עצמי לאהוב, לאהוב עם כל השנאה שבתוכי לאהוב, לאהוב לא כל העולם אשם בבעיות שלי בהפסדים ובספקות שלי ואיפה כל המעשים והמידות שלי הרי אני מקבל על עצמי אני לוקח אחריות על כל השטויות שעשיתי מכל מי שפגעתי מבקש סליחה על החומות היסוסים המגננה השליליות והקטנה על קינה ועל דינה מקבל על עצמי להבין שאני פזיז ועצבני ולקבל את ההשלכות של הטעויות שלי עם כל הכעסים בלב על כל הסובבים אותי הציפייה הזאת שינהגו או יחשבו כמוני
על עצמי לאהוב אהבה שאינה תלויה בדבר לחיות בשלום עם מי שאני וסוף סוף להניח לעבר קבל על עצמי להניח לזו שאהבתי לחיות את החיים שלה בשקט ולאחל לה רק טוב גם לה מגיע לאהוב גם לה מגיע לאהוב